Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, take your time right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz. But you moving kind of fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.
You are listening to Time Out. I am your host, Sylvia Crowley Milbury, and I want to thank our listeners for tuning in week after week. The numbers have been great each week, no matter who I bring on the show. And actually, our show has been selected as the feature show on Blog Talk Radio. It'll be posted on tomorrow. So congratulations to all of us for that. Tonight's guests hail from Boston, Massachusetts. She's a brand strategist of Eventually Assured, an author and personal advisor. She has over 15 years of brand development and communications experience. Her clientele includes author/actor Isaac Washington, Kevon Edmonds from the R&B group After Seven, actress Megan Good, Free, the former host of 106 and Park, actor Terrence Howard. She also represented corporations such as Reebok, Prudential, J.P. Morgan, John Hancock, as well as some nonprofits such as the National Urban League, the One Family Campaign, and the National Coalition of 100 Black Women, just to name a few. It is my distinct honor to introduce Monica Koss.
Hello.
That was your applause, Monica. Welcome to Time Out. You have quite the schedule, so you're literally taking a time out to slow down for tonight's show. So thank you for being with us tonight, Monica.
You're welcome. I'm delighted.
I want to just go ahead and ask this right off the bat. Can you explain to us exactly what a brand strategist does?
Yeah, you know, brand strategist is a term for people who work on developing the packaging of a person or a company or something and presenting it to the marketplace. And so in the brand strategy work that I do, I work with individuals in terms of packaging and delivering their brand, their authentic brand, to the marketplace. And then I also work with organizations on developing their brand, and sometimes that will be through developing their employees' personal brands or creating marketing concepts that they then purchase that will further the brand that they are looking to deliver to the marketplace.
So do you have to major in marketing to be a brand strategist? Or what was your major?
Been helpful. Yeah, it would have been helpful. I didn't know this is what I wanted to be. I mean, part of the whole authentic living movement that I'm a part of, it is around that whole helping people to understand what they want their environment and their purpose and the things that they're connected to look like, because I was always very good at math. All the adults in my life sort of, you know, led me towards a career in finance, which I was in for many years at the same time I was running my brand strategy company. But there was always more. And so while it would have been helpful to major in marketing, I didn't. It just was something that I had a passion for. And then just start, you know, being with mentors and other people who were doing it, watching people from afar, and then self-study.
So you're the chief brand strategist for your company, Evidently Assured. Can you explain to our listeners why you chose that particular name?
Yeah, so when I first started doing this work, it started off as personal branding, because when I was in corporate America, you know, people used to always come to my desk, and, you know, you might be this kind of person, Sylvia, or you might know people where, you know, they always call you or come to you for some just reasonable advice. And I was that person at my job, and And what I noticed is that the people that were starting to, you know, that were coming to me, the feedback that I needed to give them had everything to do with how they were showing up in the world, whether it be through their communication style, how they looked, you know, their character in terms of not being dependable. And so when I was explaining in the workshop, you know, what my goal was to get them to be a certain way. And the example I used was I said, you know, have you ever walked in, has seen somebody walk into a room and something about the way they look makes you take a double take? Like you look back, but you're not exactly sure. You've never seen them before. You don't know them to be anybody famous. And I said, well, you know, that person is obviously confident or evidently assured. So it was a play on words from that. And that's what I'm trying to get people and organizations to be evidently assured about their brand.
That's brilliant. Why do you think there's a higher demand for brand strategists today? Like 10 years ago, really only megastars had a brand. But now there are many more people who are into multiple streams of income. So they have a lot of different things going on and seem to need some type of packaging. Why do you feel like it's more it's higher in demand today?
Well, the interesting thing is that everybody has a brand. It's just, you know, the language around what this is new. So that people started, you know, naming when people were rude or didn't have integrity or maybe they showed up inappropriately dressed. But it was probably about 15 years ago that the brand part of it came up. And I think today it's because brands are distributed so quickly and in so many, you know, through so many different mediums, social media being the biggest one, where it's real time information that is given about a person's brand, whether it be, you know, you run into, I don't know, Rihanna at the airport and she's rude. And so then somebody tweets about that right away. And so, you know, she's more, her people, her team is, you know, more cognizant now of it because of how quickly you can have a fall from grace, particularly if you're in the public eye. But then it doesn't really, it's not really that different for those of us that are not notable personalities, so to speak, where, you know, our brand walks into the room before we get there usually and it stays behind when we leave. And before, I think that people just were not as aware of what it is that they were communicating and not being as intentional about it. I think that's the goal of personal brand is to, one, identify authentically who it is that you are and what you're trying to communicate, and then how do you best do that and make it congruent in all the ways that you deliver it.
I read some of your bio at the beginning of the show, and it all sounds great, but I know there's no way you could accomplish that much and be as wise as you are without having gone through some pivotal moments, which I like to refer to as timeout moments, that have shaped you into who you are today. So I want to talk about one of your timeout moments. And in preparing for the show, you mentioned that your mom was in a car accident when you were younger. Can you tell us about that period of your life?
Yeah, when I was in the sixth grade, I went to a school in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania. My hometown is Philadelphia. And as a rite of passage in the sixth grade, we would take a week-long trip to a place called Echo Hill. And upon returning on the bus from Echo Hill, instead of my mom meeting me, the headmaster of the school, Bruce, met me off the bus. And, you know, he said, come with me. And so, I had this concerned look on my face, and I saw my Aunt Betty and a woman named Miss Prysock, who I was very close to. And Bruce said, you know, I have something to tell you. He had his arm on my shoulder, and, you know, I'm looking like, what is it? And where's my mother? And he said, you know, your mom's been in a car accident. And I don't remember anything else he said, but I do remember asking if she could walk and if she could talk. And they told me she could, which was a total lie, but I think they just didn't want me to freak out right then and there and cause a scene. And so they didn't let me see my mom for 2 days because she would, now I know, you know, she was in ICU and struggling for her life. She had punctured a lung, broken 8 ribs, broke her collarbone, she had a huge gash in her head, and it was a mess. And so when I finally got to see her, you know, even right now, I just remember walking into the room and, you know, it was only God, I think, that held me up and didn't let me faint. But I just remember thinking, like, she could not be here. And that, mm-hmm. you know, that gave me reason for pause, even in sixth grade.
Wow. So was there anything that you learned from that timeout moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was about taking people and opportunities and experiences for granted. Now, did I learn that on a, you know, do I know that as much as I know it as an adult? No, I was still a sixth grader, but it just made me appreciate the moments with my mother and with my family more, because it was never so real to me that that my mom could be gone than when I saw her on that bed.
Right. Shifting gears a little bit, you recently became an author, and you wrote a book mm-hmm. called The Things I Used to Do to Sneeze. And I know I have several people listening today because they really want to know what the heck you meant by The Things I Used to Do to Sneeze. Can you please tell our listeners why you chose that particular title for your book?
Absolutely. So I love the physical sensation of sneezing, and I always have. And when I was younger, I used to do a lot of different things to make myself sneeze. Some of it included, you know, sniffing pepper, putting feathers from the pillows up my nose, and other antics that I won't gross you out with. But it was all in order. The whole goal was to get this physical sensation of sneezing. And, you know, when I was thinking about how do I deliver a message to people around authentic living that would make sense, you know, what could I use? And so I got to thinking about these sort of false things that I use to create a physical sensation, and I paralleled it with all of the things that we do to create the false things we do to create emotional sensations. And so,
wow.
you know, many of us want to be, you know, there's certain sensations that we all crave, and everybody has a different priority in terms of what they crave. Some people need respect more than they need love. Some people need to be connected more than they need to be respected. And so some people need to be important more than they need to be wanted. But whatever your sensation is, how you get there is either based upon your own value system or it's based upon society's value system. And so when it's based upon society's value system, it's the same as me sniffing pepper. It's taking outside influences to create a sensation for yourself. Now, the sensation you want is real, but how you get there is what I'm asking people to revisit.
Hmm. That is so interesting. I'm going out to get the book. You referred to yourself earlier this week when we were talking as an accidental author. Can you explain to our listeners why you said that?
Yes, and particularly for the people who want to write a book, I just want you to take some of the pressure off yourself around writing a book, because everybody's process is different, and sometimes people like to you know, give the 1-2-3s around how to do it. But I went to a conference in 2011, and I had a really profound moment with a really good friend of mine. And when I got back from the conference, I literally sat down at my computer, and 8 weeks later, there was a book. And I mean, it went from some days I'd be up at 6 and write until, you know, 4 in the afternoon, or sometimes I'd start writing at 8 p.m. and I wouldn't start writing until 5:30 in the morning. And like it, you know, and I did whatever my body said. So sometimes all I would have is like a sleeve of Oreos to eat for the entire day. So whatever my creative process was, I just sort of let it happen. But at the end of 8 weeks, it was literally this body of work. And I was like, okay, wow. Wait, you know, I didn't set out, so I didn't go through the process of finding an agent or a publisher. How do I really get this out? Because my goal really in spreading the word around authentic living was not to make money, although obviously I have to, you know, make a living. But really, through this work, I've just run into so many people who are who are disconnected to life and who are so busy chasing the labels that society is going to give them that they have all this regret. And I don't care if they're 30, 40, 50, 60, I've talked to hundreds, probably over 1,000 people at this point, whether it be their job or relationships that they're in. You know, I just felt like people could do better and have a more authentic way of being. And so I found a online self-publishing website, and I just sort of put the book out there. And that's why I called myself The Accidental Authors, because I, you know, I didn't have a budget for marketing and I didn't do media blitz. I just sort of did things as they came up. But, you know, the book started to open a lot of doors, which is why I had to clean up my act and and put out a second edition with hopefully no, but certainly many, much less typos than the self-published one.
And so the second edition came out maybe 2 weeks ago or a week ago?
Yes, yes, and it debuted at the National Urban League Conference this past weekend with great response. And just looking forward to, we'll have an official launch this fall and hope to do a small 5 to 7 city book tour with the message and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that you talked to over at least 1,000 people on this topic. Why, in your opinion, what are some of the things that people were doing or using to create whatever their desire or sensation
mm-hmm.
was? Can you give us some examples just so that maybe
mm-hmm.
we can hear something that strikes a nerve with us, within us?
Absolutely. Some of it was around befriending or being in the networks of people that they didn't actually care about. So they were sort of putting up with a particular group of people and spending their valuable time with groups of people that they actually didn't want to be around, but it created this sensation of being important or being in the know. You know, it made them feel like they were they had arrived. Or people who really cared more about the types of experiences they had than they cared about material things. But because of the pressures of their environment, the people they knew or the people on their jobs, they purchased the material things that made them feel more successful. And then on their look back, you know, they wish they had spent that money maybe taking a family cruise or, you know, creating more experiences. Or sometimes people got married because that was the next thing to do or their family said that they should do it. And so, or, you know, even better, there was an emotional void in a person. So they wanted to create this sensation of love, but they created it through being in a relationship with somebody that really, you know, they didn't share the same values. And so, again, it's that people get to the end or stop for a moment, because certain things do make you take a time out. And when you reflect on it, you know, it was just the regret that people were expressing to me. And I said, you know, people often say things like, you know, wisdom comes with age and, you know, we all have to make mistakes. And that is true. We do have to make mistakes. But I know for sure now that the level of regret that we experience, at least in this country, does not have to happen at the rate that it happens. Because, you know, we're given our value system when we're younger. And if I could keep going on this subject for a second, you know, think about when kids are younger. And it's a little bit of a digression, but it proves a point. When kids are younger, let's say we're at a, you know, a kindergarten graduation and they ask a child what they want to be when they grow up, and a child gets up and says, oh, I want to be a teacher. And, you know, we clap, and then the next kid gets up and they say, what do you want to be? And the child says, I want to be a, you know, a surgeon. We practically stand to our feet. And so from the time when we are little, society is giving us cues on what are the better paths to take, quote unquote. And so instead of pursuing your passion and your actual dream, you end up pursuing something that isn't actually in line. And then there's no formal process for us, again, at least in this country, to check in with ourselves and say, am I on my authentic path, or am I still continuing on the path that was given to me?
Wow. I think you're on to something big, because I think there are a lot of people who struggle with this, especially with the way that social media has influenced our world, because now you can see more than you could, and you could, you know, there's like this quest to be famous. I have a niece, and she, if you ask her what she wants to be when she grows up, she says she wants to be a superstar, which is actually what I said I wanted to be when I was 6 years old, you know. And my dad was like, what kind of major are you going to have in college if you're going to be a superstar? You know, like, pick something else. And so, but there is this whole quest with being famous and liked, you know, like me on Facebook or follow me on Twitter, you know. And so it's just pushing people towards, you know, being famous, being an entertainer, being in the spotlight, and that might not necessarily be what's right for them. And and there are a lot of pressures from media and our society to maybe get married at a certain age or start your family at a certain age. And if you're, you know, in your 40s, like I was when you got married, it was just kind of like, well, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you married? That's the first question people ask you, you know.
That's right.
And so so it's very, very interesting. You told me earlier that you attended a Quaker school when you were younger. Can you explain to our listeners, I mean, that was, when I talked to you, that was the first time I had ever heard of a Quaker school. Where I went, where I grew up, there was private school and public school, that's it. And my niece went to a Montessori school, so I'm familiar with that, but I had never, I guess I should say, I had never had an encounter with someone who actually went to a Quaker school. So can you explain to our listeners what that is exactly?
Yeah, it is, it wasn't actually, it's no, you know, it is in the private school listing. So, you know, like the president's kids go to Sidwell Friends, and the school that I had attended for part of my education was Abington Friends, and then there's, you know, Germantown Friends. There's lots of Friends schools. They are private institutions. And they are, you know, they don't push religion. So, you know, there was no religion that was actually taught at the school at all every Wednesday. But it was about peace and sort of centering yourself and doing good and doing well and giving back. And, you know, the most religious, I guess, or spiritual thing that we did is on Wednesdays we would go to something called meeting. And for 45 minutes you'd have to sit, which was very difficult for me. You'd have to sit and you could pray, you could meditate. At some point, I think they let us read, but you just couldn't talk. And it was really a time of reflection. And you could stand up and share any moments of reflection that you had. And I remember, you know, after my mom started to recover from the car accident, that I stood up and I shared about that. But it was just a time for community.
Well, I actually looked it up, and I want to read something to our listeners, and you can correct me if you feel like this is incorrect, but it's the article that I read, it said, the Quaker school experience is the basic belief that we are all teachers and learners, and that each child has a unique gift and talent. Students are called upon to discover their own voices and interests within the framework of rigorous college preparatory academics. The foundation of the educational experience is built upon the ideal that students' quality of character, meaning what kind of people they are becoming, is as important to their lives and to the world as their intellectual growth. So would you say that that pretty much sums up what a Quaker school is about?
Absolutely. I mean, we did everything from, we did, you know, sometimes the campus where I studied had like a little lake, and sometimes the teacher would say, let's just go have class by the lake today. And then there was study hall. So it was very much like college, where you had points of the day where you could just go do sort of free study, and there were lots of places on campus where you could do that.
Was it a boarding school? Did you stay the night there?
No, this was not boarding.
Okay.
It was K-12, but there was no boarding.
Okay. Now, do you think that going to a Quaker school helped mold you or mold your life into kind of how you are, into this authentic living? Do you think that played a role in it at all?
I guess, you know, I never thought of it in terms of the Quaker school, but certainly one of the things that I just can't ever thank my mom enough for is giving me so many varied experiences in our life, from public school to private school, you know, to going to see art and to, you know, going to the sticks of Alabama and visiting family. And so I think just the broad range of experience, and I put Abington Friends in that bucket, was, I think, absolutely critical. You know, there were people at my school who had, you know, some had bowling alleys in their basements, some of their parents had private jets, and others of them just sort of lived in, you know, middle-class neighborhoods and didn't have that kind of wealth. So it was just, again, engaging with so many different kinds of people that I think absolutely molded me into the person that I am today.
Okay. We are going to take a short break. When I say short, I mean very short. And we'll be back to hear about Monica Kaus' Time Out moment in just a second.
No allowances. You won't see me start chasing like astrologists. I'm journey bound. See me bouncing like the alchemist. Swimming the rivers and touching the highest mountain tips. A surrenderer, an adventurer. Life should be similar to watching good cinema. View it from afar, break it down like an integer. Keeping it real is easy when we keep it simple.
For a roundup of the week's events, interviews, and a whole lot more, tune in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern for the FSP Cruise Show, featured at blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. Here's a sample.
We have Mr. Stephen A. Smith. Hello, Stephen A. I'm glad to, this is Jerry, your host, along with my co-host Black and Jeff on here. Glad to join us.
What's up, fellas? How y'all doing?
What's going on, Stephen?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
You can also visit fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com for archives, advertising, and other information. The FSP Crew Show. Information, motivation, variety.
You are listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crawley. I'm talking with brand strategist and author Monica Kaus. Monica, let's move into your greatest Time Out moment. I know you've had many Time Out moments, but what would you consider your most challenging Time Out moment?
The most challenging, I guess, to date was probably a few years ago, in 2008, what I deem the financial summer of doom. It was it was 2009. It was when I decided to get a divorce and I moved out of the house and you know, I was still trying to run two households, and I just had a lot, you know, I hadn't expected it to happen so fast, and I just, you know, and not that I was super wealthy throughout my life, not at all, but the way that I lived, I was able to, you know, kind of do what I wanted to do within reason with my resources, and so I'd never really budgeted before. And all of a sudden, I found myself having to say no to different opportunities, you know, to go places, having to, you know, curb my spending on clothes and shoes and eating out. And, you know, it got really bad. Even the place where I moved out with for a while, I couldn't even pay them. And that was a huge Time Out moment. I mean, literally, I was writing down if I, you know, bought a cup of coffee. I mean, I don't drink coffee, but I bought a cup of hot chocolate. I was writing down exactly what it was that I was getting so that I could keep track of the little bit of money that I had, again, while I was trying to operate two households, and so we figured everything out.
And so what did you learn from that Time Out moment?
The thing that I learned, and it is so incredibly clear to me right now, is that, you know, I feel like I had to learn how to budget, because I couldn't be faithful over what God has given me now if he didn't take me through that summer. I would have just been blowing it. And so, you know, the Bible talks about being faithful over the little, and then he will make you faithful over the much. And in the moment, I couldn't see it at all. But as soon as I feel like I kind of got it and settled into it and said, you know what, well, this life is cyclical. This is my life right now. Let me just, you know, sort of be about my financial business. And then, it, you know, when you settle into where God has you, I believe you just ultimately, and, you know, you sort of pass the test a little quicker than when you fight it. My friend Tony calls it flowing with the river. And so I just decided to flow with the river, and then my circumstances turned around pretty quickly. And I know it doesn't always happen that way, but I think I resigned. I surrendered.
Wow. So you said your greatest timeout moment was came after you had your divorce, and that's when you experienced your financial summer of doom.
Mm-hmm.
So, tell me this, what is your definition of success? We had an interesting conversation about this a couple of days ago as we were preparing for the show, and I thought your answer was very, very interesting, and I would like for our listeners to hear that. What's your definition of success?
Yeah, so it is not a rigid definition, but I know what it includes, and it includes being able to be there for my children and the major events that they have going on in their lives. In addition to, not just being there, but also not being there for actual events, but being there just to talk with them, you know, to be present for, you know, everyday kind of routine moments with school and assemblies and football games. And, I tell my children, because I do travel for work, I can't make every game or every play, but you tell me the big ones. I'm going to do the best I can to make them. And for the most part, I do. And then, you know, I want to be really good at what I do for a living, but not sacrificing time with my children, family, or friends, or the experiences that I would like to create, or the lives that I'd like to impact. And so it's interesting that when I first started this business, a lot of people tried to define, and again, here comes those outside experiences that creep into your head. Well, people said, you know, if you just get that one A-lister, you know, your business is just going to blow up and you'll experience so much success. And in the moment, you jump on board and you go, right, you know, I made a list of the A-listers that I could go after and who I had contact with. And, you know, then I realized, you know, because I signed on a client you know, that I probably shouldn't have, and we just didn't have the same values. But again, I hadn't written the book at that point. And so while the pay was good, right, so I was certainly experiencing the financial success, my soul was not successful. I was not as present with my children because I was worried more often. And sometimes when this person would call my cell phone, I would get physically ill. And so on the outside, people are looking like, oh, I see you, you know, blowing up, and people are putting it on Facebook. And I said, you know, that's just so amazing, but, you know, to get these labels, but at what cost? And originally, initially, the labels feel good. You know, when people say, oh, she's so successful, or, oh, she's so whatever the label is. But when you look at your own life, and you have to get home and look at yourself in the mirror, and you see that there is not the level of success that you planned on experiences, that is also another reason for a timeout, to say, you know, what am I really doing? What is it that I really want? You know, check sort of, I call it your TPS, you know, how you have a GPS, a geographic positioning system. Well, this is your truth positioning system. And our values are like our coordinates. So just like the GPS will tell you to take a right on, you know, Jones Street and then go down and take a left on this street, when you look at your values, those are the coordinates by which you should be achieving your destination to truth. And if you look at your values and you realize that, let's say excellence, or that's probably too broad, but let's say education, right, is on your list of top values, but you realize that you are just sort of working so much and so routinely that you are not availing yourself of more resources, then you're not on the right street. And so we always have to stop and check our TPS to see how far off we are from our destination of truth, however, whatever we have deemed that to be, not society, because they'll get you off track and you'll be going down the street of, you know, wanting to be famous and going down the street of overspending and just realize that you are way off track.
Wow. I'm writing. I'm a licensed minister, by the way, on top of all the other things that I do.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm writing a message about masks and taking off the mask. A lot of people wear masks to kind of cover up what's going on in our lives. And so as I'm writing this message, I myself, as most speakers or preachers or teachers, normally deal with the subject that you talk about. And so I have been taking off the mask and just kind of evaluating where I am, who I really am. And I know who I am, but sometimes I, as a leader, I feel a responsibility to put out positive energy and portray positive things where, you know, sometimes I'll say I'm fine when I'm not really fine. You know, I've had a horrible day, you know, but I don't want to put that weight on anybody. So I put on my I'm fine mask.
Mm-hmm.
And when people ask me, I say, oh, I'm fine. You know, and so just this whole notion of taking off that mask and like you said, with the TPS, finding your true positional system and figuring out where you are, who you are, and being comfortable in that, and you know, in terms of authentic living. So this is very interesting. I could talk to you forever. And I want to say to our listeners, as I was preparing for this show with Monica, we talked, and she called me. She had a break in between a meeting, and I was going on and on. She actually had to say, hey, Sylvia, I got to go. I have a meeting to go to. And I was like, oh, I'm getting carried away because I just could go on forever about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's so intriguing to me. I want to ask you something? Go ahead, please.
Just to the taking off the mask, you know, I think one of the important questions, and that is, why do we wear them? Because unfortunately, again, and because we're not a society that promotes self-reflection, we're more, you know, sort of finger pointers. The reason why people are scared to take off the mask is because they're scared of the labels that they'll get should people see the real them. And so I'm just encouraging, particularly, you know, and I even have to retool this for myself or catch myself when I'm about to label something. But, you know, there's a bunch of labels in our society that are good labels. You know, we want to be smart. We want to be pretty. We want to be thin. We want to be successful. We want to be famous. There's all these labels that we're chasing. Or, you know, if somebody makes a decision or about something, we will call that a good decision or a stupid decision or a bad decision. And we just have to be careful about the labels because those labels can change at any time, right? If you call somebody stupid today and they do something good tomorrow, now you've changed the label. So I think when we stop using the labels, then it will help people stop hearing labels being thrown around, and then they'll stop being afraid of being labeled, and they will be able to be their authentic selves.
There was I posted something on Facebook the other day that talked about, it was this guy who said that his wife wanted to go natural, and he wasn't in support of it because, you know, he was taught his whole life through the men in his family, you know, that you find a woman with, you know, nice long flowing hair, and so that's what he did. He found his wife; she had nice flowing hair, nice long flowing hair, and then you know, once they got married, she said, I want to go natural, and he felt like, you know, how is she going to look now, how are we going to look as a couple? Like, he had a lot of just hang-ups and insecurities that he had to get over, in terms of, you know, he just had this vision of her with this mini nappy afro, you know what I mean, as opposed to supporting her in terms of being authentically who she was and what she wanted to be. Now, obviously, going natural isn't for everyone, but for her, that was a decision that she made, you know, and it just, it took him some time to kind of, it had to grow on him a little bit, but he actually posted a picture of him and his wife, and she looked beautiful with her, you know, with her short natural hair. It was beautiful, and you could tell he felt proud to be with her, and he was comfortable with it, but that is another example of the voices, you know, and people giving labels and judging and saying this or that, that made him form an opinion where, you know, he wasn't even supportive of his wife making this move. So I think that's very interesting.
Well, I also think it is, you know, this is where communication, you know, whether you value it or not, or it ends up in your top three values, it just you know, relationships only work to the degree that you can be authentic, because the reality is men are physical creatures. And so I don't want to be so dismissive and kind of jump on his back for feeling the way he felt, because the reality is when he looks upon a woman, he has an experience, right? And when he looked upon his wife, he was attracted to her in a certain way. So I appreciate his honesty, but he had to retrain his brain, right? Mm-hmm. Or be so connected to her that, you know, that he redefined beauty. But I don't want to be so quick to say that, you know, men are so shallow because, oh my gosh, I can't believe, you know, he's, you know, looking at other women because his wife gained 50 pounds. But really, a man's first attraction to us, 9 times out of 10, is a physical thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, different people have different takes on it. My husband actually prefers natural hair, you know, in the less makeup and the less, the less you do to try to make yourself beautiful is better for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I'm the one that wasn't quite there yet, you know. I've tried to go natural twice and to no avail. I'm like, oh, no, I need my perm back.
That's right.
I'm not ready yet. Maybe when I turn 50. So, and so, and my mom was a hairdresser, so it stems way back to, you know, whenever I had a Christmas play or Easter speech, my mom would do my hair, and when it was done, they'd parade me through the house, and the family would say, "Oh, she's so cute! Look how cute!" You know, and that was associated around my hair being done.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what it taught me as a grown up is that whenever I had to perform, like if I had a big basketball game or if I had a, you know, any kind of big show or something like that, my hair had to be done. It had to be flowing. It had to be bouncing. And the more it bounced, the higher I could jump on the court, you know. So it's taken me some time to kind of get there. But, you know, different guys have different preferences. And it's not to knock them for that. You know, there's a certain thing that attracts them when they look at a woman. And that's what, in that story and on Facebook, that's what initially attracted him to his wife. That's why, you know, he thought, like, this is why I'm marrying you, because you have this look that I want, that I want to wake up to every single day. And so this is just interesting as we travel this journey to find our authentic selves and the people around us even accepting that and embracing it for, you know, for who we are.
Sure.
I want to ask you this question. Are you debt-free?
I am debt-free, finally, praise the Lord.
Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
I want to
ask you,
what was your approach to tackling your debt? Because people do it different ways, but how did you become debt-free? Can you explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, I think the thing is it really depends on what your situation is. You know, again, there's no 1, 2, 3, because when I left, when I was going through a divorce and I had that financial summer of doom and finally settled in, I ended up closing a real estate deal at the end of that summer that put me back in the black. And so, that was a lump sum. I didn't, I didn't become debt-free then, but I just sort of got my regular bills back into clear view. But then when I started running my company and getting larger paychecks based upon projects, I was able to pay off in chunks. And what I knew is that every time I paid something off, there was a level of liberation that came that I don't think I've ever experienced. Because even when I was married and kind of had, like, you know, the good debt and even some of the bad debt, I knew you know, we could still pay the bills, so I never really worried about being debt-free because, okay, whatever. But when you are trying to build a company and when you have, you know, 2 children to care for, although I am, you know, raising them with my ex-husband, we are a unit in raising our children, so I don't consider myself a single mom. But when you have that, you know, burden of it's just me kind of, then you're more compelled to shake loose or become mm-hmm. get free from the you know the people that you're beholden to. So I did it in chunks. I didn't I didn't set out a plan per se. It was just kind of like, oh wait, this amount of money allows me to do this, so I'm just going to do it. And then that felt good. And then the next chunk of money I got, I paid off the next thing until it was all
right.
gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, my approach to becoming debt-free, and first of all, you said that you talked about good debt and bad debt. Good debt is considered your mortgage, you know, on a house or something like that. And bad debt is considered your credit cards, liabilities that are taking money out that will never bring money back in. And mm-hmm. so my approach to becoming debt-free was to attack the bill that was most attainable.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I'm wired is I'm very result-oriented. I've taken a Briggs test. I've taken the DISC test, all the personality tests you could take. I've done them with my teams when I coached. And so the common trait for all of them is that I am result-oriented. I want to see the
mm-hmm.
results. So the quicker I see results, I become very highly motivated. So I
mm-hmm.
attacked the smallest bill first. I refinanced the house, and so I had a refi loan with Huntington Bank. So
mm-hmm.
I worked aggressively towards paying it off, meaning I paid the minimum payment towards all my other bills, but I paid extra, like an extra $100 or $200 towards that Huntington loan. So I was very
mm-hmm.
aggressive with that one first. Once that
mm-hmm.
was paid off, then I was able to see success. And I was one step
mm-hmm.
closer to, you know, being debt-free and seeing less debt on my financial spreadsheet. Then
mm-hmm.
I took the money that I would normally pay towards Huntington, and I put it towards a credit card bill, along
mm-hmm.
with what I normally would pay on that credit card bill. And I kept
mm-hmm.
doing that until that was paid off. Meanwhile,
mm-hmm.
I was just paying the minimum on the rest of the bills. Then I took, you know, what I paid off for the credit card bill and for Huntington, and I put it towards the next thing. And I kept doing that until I chipped away at being debt-free. But the key is to pay more than a minimum payment so that you can chip away at the interest that is drawn, you know, monthly, you know, whenever you owe something. And so that was my plan of attack, and the
mm-hmm.
more I started to see success, the more motivated I got until
mm-hmm.
it just happened. So different people have different ways.
Totally. And the thing I will say is, you know, and I probably would have been this way if I had to, you know, if I did it that way, was, you know, I like to shop. I just do. And so I have to have, in that regard, an accountability partner. And I have one now, you know, somebody who knows what my financial goals are, and I'm accountable to them to make, you know, when you have to report to somebody what's happening, because I, you know, I don't believe in sort of going it alone and doing everything myself. But when you have, especially if you're a person who's not as organized or you don't have the willpower right away, because spending can be just by eating too much. You need somebody to call you on it when you're rationalizing and justifying stuff that maybe is not as good for you or your financial plan.
Right. My sister is that person for me, and
mm-hmm.
I think I'm that person for her. There's sometimes where she's out and she's just like on a major shopping spree, and she'll call me and be like, "Help! I'm shopping!" And I'll have to say, "Okay, do you need this or do you want it? You don't
mm-hmm.
need that, so put that back." But those, you know, you need this. You need that suit because you have a presentation coming up, and if it's on sale, I would say get both of those. And we do that. We talk each other out of buying stuff, and then if we feel like it really is a good bargain and we haven't just completely lost our mind, then we'll say, "You know what? Get it. You got the money. Just do it."
Mm-hmm.
But my rule is when I buy something, I try to give something away in my closet.
Mm-hmm.
So I can
mm-hmm.
only, I have to take something out in order to put something in my closet. That's my rule.
Right.
And sometimes,
yeah.
sometimes I fail at that, but for the most part, that helps me because as I'm shopping, I'm thinking, okay, what are you going to give away if you buy this? And
mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything, then okay, leave it here, put it back.
Right. That's
right. What's next for Monica Koss? You know, you talk about what your definition of success is, and, you know, you have your company, Evidently Assured, you have your book. What's next for you?
Well, I am launching this fall the Authentic Leadership Academy for Young Women, and I will take this message. You know, one thing is when I talk about authentic living with adults, in addition to saying, you know, what you're asking us to do is very difficult, the next thing I hear is, I wish I had known this when I was in school or a young person. And then when I talk to the college crowds, they say, oh, my goodness, this would have been a great conversation when I was in high school. And then, you know, and then educators come up to me and say, you know, this is really something that the young people in middle school need to know. So while I absolutely do co-ed workshops, I find that in this day and age right now, it's the little girls who are suffering most from trying to find their authentic selves and how do they best express that in a way that doesn't leave them depressed and disappointed with the outcomes of some of the choices they make. So I look forward to that. And also, you know, to the official release of the book coming out this fall and hopefully go on a few tours with the book and really just, you know, try to make a difference so that people can live with less regret going forward. And lastly, I would love to have a radio or television show around this whole authentic living, so I'm working on that as well.
Our producer's on the call right now. I hope he's listening to that because we have some huge things that we have in the making. We can't reveal that just yet, but there's another step coming to this. But there is a question in the chat room, and they want to know your thoughts on separation of needs and desires. That's the question.
You know, yeah, that is an interesting one, probably for a longer discussion, and I don't know if I have the answer to it per se, but, you know, desires, I think as long as they are in line with our value system, that they don't disrupt our life in a way that leaves us with regret, I think that desires are fine to go after, right? Because I desire to be successful. But if you are, let's say, in a marriage and you desire someone else, then you have to think about what giving into that desire is going to do in the context of the relationship. Because then you, if you value your spouse, you value honesty or you value integrity, that's the whole point of this whole value discovery, is that if you make decisions in your life, and I mean everything from aesthetics, you know, if you're going to get a weave or a perm, if you're going to buy, you know, spend money on Christian Louboutins or, you know, buy a pair of flip-flops, or if you're going to take the Wall Street broker job versus taking a job as, you know, an administrator in a school system, if you know your values and you bump up every decision against your value system, I think, you know, you'll be able to satisfy desires and needs without having negative consequences.
Well, hopefully that answers their question in the chat room. We've got quite the discussion going on in the chat room. If you would like to ask a question and you're online, you need to call in. The number is 347-367-3220, and you can press 1 to participate. But I want to ask you this question, and we talked about this a little bit when you and I spoke. How do you want to be remembered?
You know, I want to be remembered as a person who assisted in people's progression, you know, moving people from where they are now to what's next. You know, a lot of people that I talk to in this authentic living are stuck. You know, they either feel trapped in the routine of life or they feel, you know, a little disenfranchised with whatever system they're in, whether it be corporate America or in, you know, just in being in America. And so I think taking action is what I want to be remembered for, is, you know, help, is that people would have said that when they were stuck and they called me, that I helped them get to the next point.
Okay. Can you tell our listeners before we leave how they can get your book?
Yes, the book is currently available on Amazon.com. You can also go to MonicaCost.com and get a copy of the book, and prayerfully it will be in the brick-and-mortar bookstores like Barnes & Noble coming this fall. But again, you can go to MonicaFox.com or Amazon.com and look up the things I used to do to sneeze.
And if people are interested in using you as a brand strategist, can you tell them how they can reach you?
Yes, they can send an email to assistant@evidentlyassured.com, or they can send an email to Monica@MonicaCost.com.
Okay. Well, I want to leave our listeners with a couple of questions. I'm listening to a series by T.D. Jakes, and it is blowing my mind. I've been posting a lot of things and keeping a lot of notes, but just wanted to say this to our listeners. Are you doing what's in you? Have you spent the appropriate amount of time searching through your inventory, or are you so engrossed with the inventory of others that you have forfeited the value of being who you are, forsaking the hope of your calling, missed your opportunity, and spent your life being a cheap copy of a great original? You must authentically be who you are. That's my time for tonight. Next week, which is August 5th, we will be premiering our TV debut featuring head coach and author Charlotte Smith. For those of you who don't know, Charlotte Smith was the person who hit the buzzer-beating shot to win a national championship for North Carolina, and she's also the author of When Coaches Pray. So she will be our guest on the show, and you can see the show timeout for the very first time at our regular scheduled time, 7 p.m., and you can also see it at fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com. And it will be posted on my Timeout Facebook page as well. And you can also see the TV debut on Elon Women's Basketball Facebook page as well as my Facebook page. But I'll post further details about the show on that Timeout page. So go there, like the page, and you'll get updates that will be sent to your Facebook notifications, all right? But we're doing it big. Don't miss out on being part of history. And you can say, I remember when I saw her on the TV show for her premiere debut. So this is Time Out with Sylvia. Have a good week, and remember, be the best you that you can possibly be. God bless.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you want to go, what you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, they gon' need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, teach
you something right. Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz, but you moving kinda fast. Keep sweats, you gotta make it last, live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.